You are now listening to the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast, where the worlds of sports medicine and performance collide. My name is Mike Quintons. I'm a physical therapist with an entrepreneurial mindset that specializes in treating orthopedic and sports injuries. I'm bringing on the brightest and sharpest in the field of sports medicine to share their best practices and explore the gap where medicine meets performance. What's up, Performance Therapy Nation? This is Mike Quintons, your host of the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast. I will be joined today by strength conditioning coach Rob Rubina for most, if not all, of season four. Our special guest today is Mark Jesse Jr. We will dive into his experience as a strength conditioning coach for the Philadelphia Phillies, single A affiliate, Jersey Shore Blue Claws, as well as his experiences as a strength conditioning coach and a physical therapy strength conditioning hybrid clinic. Jesse joined the Phillies in 2022, his first season working in professional baseball. He spent part of the last season with the Florida Complex League Phillies and part of the season with the Blue Claws. Prior to the Phillies, Mark served as head strength conditioning coach for the College of Southern Nevada's baseball team from August 2020 to December 2021. He previously served as the Director of Wellness and Sports Performance at Tim Souder Physical Therapy, Wellness and Sports Performance in Las Vegas, Nevada. He received his bachelor's degree in kinesiology from Penn State University and is currently the founder and president of Landshark Performance, which is a hybrid training business offering both remote and in-person training.
There you go. Brought the West Coast kid east. Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Philly area. So, okay. Yeah, like born and raised. I was born in the city and then raised in the suburbs.
Okay. What high school?
North Penn.
Okay. All right. Big school.
Yeah.
Cool, man. And then what brought you out to Nevada?
It was the middle of COVID, and I just finished up my internship at Cressy Sports Performance, and John O'Neill, their director, called me and was like, hey, take a look at this job. Like, I think it's a good opportunity. And talked to my wife now, girlfriend at the time, was like, you want to move to Vegas? She was like, let's go. So the rest is history.
That's awesome, man. Congrats. That's a great experience. And so that's a connection with you too. Is it Cressy? Are there other connections?
All right. Westchester.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Yeah, definitely not North Penn.
No.
Haven Penn. Baseball. Had some good games back in the day. Yeah, and then baseball. So let's dive into this, man. So baseball strength conditioning coach, single A. Now let's be honest, like your relationship goes beyond just a single A affiliate team, right? Like, you worked with higher level athletes, maybe even like guys who are like spending some time with the single A affiliate. So what was that experience like, man? So summarize it.
Oh man, it was awesome. I mean, it was a great 2 years of my life. Obviously, like being a Philly kid and being able to work for my hometown team was something that like I've always dreamed of. To have that opportunity was special. And yeah, I mean, I worked with majority, once the season broke, we would work with high A, Jersey Shore. But in spring training, we'd work with everybody, you know, guys from the Dominican League to guys in AAA. So you definitely get to see a little bit of everything. We'd help out sometimes on like the big league side. So you get to see that as well. So you're exposed to a lot of different players, a lot of different training strategies, a lot of different coaches. And you just kind of get immersed in baseball.
I mean, it's a lot, I would imagine, right? And so let's get into like an obvious question that I think everyone listening is probably thinking, what's it like training pitchers versus non-pitchers?
Yeah. So I would say for pitchers and position players, it's not necessarily like a crazy difference. I think at the end of the day, like we still have our main lifts. Guys are still going to do what they need to do to get ready to play. But for position players, I would say there's a lot less conditioning involved. For our pitchers, we would always have some kind of conditioning almost every day. That would be either sprints or some kind of longer distance if they had like a recovery day scheduled. For our position players, we'd always sprint a couple times a week. We try to touch the bases at least once a week. And again, that kind of depended on like if the guy is an everyday player or if the guy is somebody that might play 2 days a week. So that was kind of a little bit more of load management, if you will. The guy had just had a game where he had, you know, he was 4-for-4, stole 2 bases and had a ton of sprint volume. Then if we had sprints scheduled the next day, probably going to skip those sprints for that guy just because he had already kind of touched threshold on like sprint volume, sprint speed, things like that. And then for the pitchers, it all kind of based around when their start day was, if they're a starter. So we would kind of have like a recovery day, a movement day, and then a compete day is what we called it. And their compete day would be their starts, or that would be if it was a bullpen guy, that would be their day that they're, you know, they're coming out of the pen that day. The bullpen guys were a little bit trickier just because you don't always know. More of our like higher priority guys, we probably know when they're going to go or at least have an idea. But then a lot of the other guys is kind of like, all right, well, he might go today. He might go tomorrow. So how do you kind of manage that load? You don't want to have him blow it out in the gym before the game. And then he ends up having to go pitch an inning. So that's kind of where like the art of coaching comes in, and just having open conversations with like the pitching coaches, understanding what the schedule is going to entail.
I noticed this. I learned this past year in tracking some single A ball. How's the schedule different than the big leagues?
Yeah. So for us, you know, in the big leagues, they'll have like 3-game series or 4-game series usually, and then they travel. So they have like a day off in between. For us, we have 6-game series. So our series run from Tuesday to Sunday. There's no travel outside of Monday or Tuesday usually. So if we're home, it's a little bit easier to manage those 6-game series because I have access to the weight room at all times. So I can get lifts in when I need to and get the sprints done on the field when I need to. When we're on the road, it's a bit more challenging. Usually we'll attend like a road gym, whether it's like a CrossFit box or if the opposing team has a gym that we can utilize. So that becomes a little bit more rigid schedule. Where we're at home, like the position guys, I'll let them kind of float, either lift on like a Tuesday and a Friday or Wednesday and a Saturday or post game. It kind of depended on the player. I'd like to try to give them some freedom and choice depending on how much they've done in like the training world.
This is fascinating. I can't imagine like a CrossFit or like a team calling us and saying, hey, yo, can we get in there at some point? So, or even post game on the road. Like I can't even imagine. What are you bringing with you
on the road? In the start of the year, I brought a lot. I would bring like a set of power blocks up to 90 pounds. I'd bring kettlebells. I'd bring med balls, bands. Like I basically had like a big box and I would just fill it with all training equipment that I think I might need on the road. And then as the year went on, like that dwindled down to like a couple kettlebells that I thought I might need and the bands that were like the necessities that I would need and cones. Because most of the time we would be able to get out and get to a gym or at least use like the opposing team's facilities. So that was like a bit easier. But when you're in high A baseball, the gyms aren't always the nicest. So our facility in Jersey was very small. You might only fit 4 or 5 guys in at a time. And a lot of the opposing teams were very similar. So you definitely had to get creative.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not kidding. Probably easier as you move up in the ranks.
Yeah, definitely. When you get to like AAA big leagues, I'm sure the road gyms are a little bit easier to use.
So I've been thinking about this and I ran this by Rob earlier, but technology, what kind of technology are you guys using even at your level or even above you guys getting into AA, AAA bigs? Kind of technology are you guys using in the weight room and then also tracking too, like tracking practices, games, et cetera?
Yeah. So when I came in, it was like a total switch of regime. So we had a new director of sports performance. We had a new minor league coordinator. At that time, we introduced force plates. We introduced the Nord board. It's like a hamstring testing device. And then most of the fields are equipped with Hawkeye, which is something that they use to track. They can track pitch velocity. They can track exit velocity off of bats. They can track sprint speeds in game. But it depended where you were to be able to track like the sprint speed information. Like that was only in like AAA big leagues and then down at our low A affiliate because that's our like big league spring training facility. So for the sprint stuff, I would end up tracking a lot of like hard sprints throughout the game and using that information as like my basically like coaching eye, like, okay, this guy's hit six hard 90s and like, okay, well, he probably doesn't need to sprint tomorrow. But the force plates and the Nord boards ended up becoming like a huge piece of our training. I hate to say like philosophy, but what we did in the weight room, we would track counter movement jumps. We track isometric mid thigh pull. So we would look at basically like mid thigh pull. You think of like max strength, max force output, and then the jumps. We would look at like their explosive, their power numbers, things like that. I loved it because I thought that it kind of shined a light on the fact that the things we do in the weight room can improve power throughout a season. Like multiple guys throughout our org got stronger, got more powerful as the year went on. And I think there's like a stigma that in baseball is such a long season, you just train to maintain
maintenance.
Yeah. And I think that is like a huge disservice to the athletes, especially in the lower levels, because a lot of them are not severely, but they're undertrained. And I think that if you just train to maintain, then you're making their off season exponentially harder.
I mean, I can definitely spin like from the athlete side, Mark, like think about going to the gym every day and be like, let's not get better today.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, 100%. That's just like tough to like,
it's boring.
Get somebody in there and be like, let's just stay where we're at.
Oh man. The best session. Some of these like post game sessions with some of our relievers who were just animals, and like they'd be in there ripping heavy trap bar deadlifts and jumping through the roof. Music's cranking and like
it's
amazing, yeah. You know, and that's in the middle of the season. Like we still have 70 more games to play and these guys are getting after it.
Now, Mark, like, what were you doing with that data? Were you writing programming? Was the coordinator writing programming? How was all this data then implemented into the S&C program? You know, was there a sports scientist that was analyzing this data? Is that up to you? And then just like, were the programs more general based? How did you get individualized with all this data?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And for us, we were lucky. So our director and our coordinator both kind of painted the picture. So this is a question I had when I was interviewing, was like, am I just following a cookie cutter program, or do I actually get the program the way I see fit for each guy? And they were like, you're the artist. We'll give you the outlines of what we think you need to do, and then you fill in the rest. The beauty of like working for that organization was I had full reign over the programming for each and every guy on my team. And with that, like, utilizing that information, the force plates, the Nord boards, things like that, it would dictate some of the programming. You know, you have guys who maybe like they have a really high mid thigh pull, but their jump numbers aren't that great. All right, well, that guy doesn't necessarily need to get, maybe doesn't need to get stronger because he is strong, but maybe we work on more of like contrast style training. We try to do more power. We do more sprint work, things like that. And I think that that was the coolest part of my job, was like, it was always an experiment in my mind. It was like, all right, if we adjust these variables in the program, what are the outcomes with the force plates, right? And then, okay, that worked. Let's keep going on that trend, follow that same solid programming and see if we can continue to see upper trajectory of power numbers, et cetera. That was, for me, it was like the most fun. And it was cool because like I could show the guys the data and be like, hey, this is where you started the year. This is where you're at now. Maybe there was a handful of guys where we were seeing power numbers go up. Their pitch velocity is also going up, things like that. You start showing guys that and then they're like, oh, wait a second. All right, yeah, I'm in. Let's go. Like, let's get after it.
That's great. Did you incorporate any like VBT stuff throughout in season at all? Or
yeah, a little bit. So we just had like output sensors. We didn't use like, we had perch the year before, but it was really hard to use in Jersey just because the camera wasn't in a great setting. So we did use some VBT. I didn't use it a ton with our younger guys, but a lot of our guys who had a little bit higher training age, I would expose those guys to it, especially the guys who, in my opinion, were pretty strong. Like we had one guy, he like deadlifts almost 600, split squats almost 400. And it's like, all right, let's move things fast and see how it goes.
This is great stuff, man. All right, like a slight pivot. So you're using all this data to modify programs, and then at what point are you incorporating it into like an off-season type of concept? How does this differ in season? You're making decisions based on volume, right? And mm-hmm. and their load management. What happens in the off-season?
Yeah, so in the off season, obviously we don't have access to like the force plates unless they're at the complex, and then we can see that data. For me, for most of the guys at least, you know, I think the off season is an opportunity to train attributes that we don't get a lot of chance to do in season. So especially for our position players, I think building a good aerobic base, I think exposing them to a very like high rep GPP phase where it's just, whether it's a 1x20 or 3x15, things like volume where they're not going to get it in season, because you can't, if you're a guy who plays 6 days a week, like if I hit you with a 3x12 or a 3x15 program, you're going to be crushed. So it's like, these are the opportunities in the off season where we can really build that base. And in my mind, that is the greatest opportunity to set them up for August, September, October, to be able to still feel good and be able to perform at their best. Because I think a lot of times people rush into the, you know, VBT or absolute strength, you know, early in the off season. And if you miss that time to hit just general physical preparedness, like you're doing a huge disservice to that athlete come the end of the season, because they're going to feel it. And then that's the biggest piece that I see, at least with a lot of our like new draft guys or like high school guys, is come August, September, like they're beat. And it's like, all right, how do we keep this guy going through the finish line? Whereas the guys who have been through that style of training and have been exposed to that, those are the guys that are like, all right, yeah, like what do we got today? I'm ready to go. I want to lift.
How are you taking into consideration speed training in season? So obviously there's cardio, right? They're hitting their, you know, like you said, you're tracking their sprints. That was a big responsibility of yours. Speed training in season versus off season. I'm not sure how much focus there is on speed or agility training in baseball. Like I think there is. I see Rob do it in here, shorter distances, at least here. I know baseball, like pitchers run, right? What have you incorporated? What have you seen change over the last few years with speed training at higher levels?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I love sprinting. I think it is, like if you had no equipment and all you could do was sprint, I think you could still see changes in people's ability to produce power,
yeah.
Everything. I think that when you look at like a world-class sprinter, they are like unbelievable athletes, right? Mm-hmm. Just massive thighs, super powerful. So for me, I would always incorporate some kind of speed work into our programming. Like I said, for our position guys, we would try to touch some kind of like max velocity sprinting once a week. We would do some shorter acceleration work once a week. And then I might throw in some like technique bounding or different skip variations throughout the week just to get them kind of exposed to different training stimulus. For our pitchers, same idea. Like they get a bad stigma that pitchers aren't athletes, but like watch a pitcher field a ground ball, you perform a PFP. Like you have to be an athlete to be able to get over and cover first base. Like if you don't sprint and then all of a sudden you go to sprint to first base and you blow a hammy or you pop an Achilles, like that's my fault in my opinion, because I didn't expose you to that. So we would always sprint in my mind, like the day before a bullpen, we would have some kind of a sprint. It might not be a huge volume of sprinting, but they would be exposed to some kind of higher level sprint work. And then we would mix in some like medicine ball work with that as well. And then on their like lift days, we wouldn't sprint. We would do more like glycolytic site work, hit the weight room, things like that. But I think that sprinting should be and is more so now becoming a bigger piece of baseball. And I think people are understanding that, like knock on wood, we were pretty healthy in Jersey Shore this year. We didn't have any hamstrings. And I think that that is partially attributed to the fact that we expose guys to sprinting often.
How much emphasis was put on that this year? Like new development, right? I mean, again, we don't have to get too deep into details, but I mean, you even said like the Nord board, like different resources there. How much emphasis was there put on health?
I think it's a big piece, especially for a lot of our like our top prospects.
Sure.
Like you never want that guy to get hurt, because then you're going to get asked some questions that you don't want to get asked. So for me, I always made sure that I was collecting data, and I was like Nords or jumps, because for me, that's backup and ammunition to be like, hey, you know, his hamstring scores are good. You know, his jump numbers are good. So
CYA.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, never mind. We do it in PT. Every single patient I see, I write a note for it, right? And I got to justify my care and why I did it. Because if it comes back on me, I'm able to say, well, here's the data. This is what I did. But I mean, even in Europe, you're dealing with assets, right?
Yeah, exactly. You're talking about guys that are worth millions of dollars.
Sure.
You know? And I think that's all extremely important in making sure that guys stay healthy, because that data can show us, you know, is there a big asymmetry? Is there a massive drop in strength or power? And then that's information that we need to look at and be like, all right, is this something we're doing, or is it a workload issue on the field? And for us, like there are certain guys that need to get faster. You know, we have some outfielders that might need to work on improving their first step or better top speed to cover ground. And then you have other guys like Justin Crawford, who's elite level speed, right? And it's like, that's a guy that I don't need to get any faster. I just need to not break that guy.
Right. Yeah. Do no harm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mark, what was your guys' like data collection when it came to like flexibility, joint range of motion? Was that more of you? Was that more of the physical therapist? How did you guys coordinate joint range of motion or flexibility into, you know, all this awesome data and then also like programming?
Yeah. So in spring training, we would collect every range of motion number you could think of. Cervical range of motion, T-spine, shoulder, hip, ankle, whatever you could think of, we collected it. And then throughout the season, we had certain things that we would kind of flag and monitor. So like pitchers, we would always monitor like hip mobility and T-spine mobility. I think those are two big pieces that guys lose throughout the season. And I don't know that there's necessarily anything you can do to stop them from losing it. You just want to try to mitigate how much they lose, because, you know, when you think of losing T-spine rotation or hip mobility, then you start to wonder, where are those stressors going? And more often than not, that's going to be the shoulder, that's going to be the elbow. And those are the guys that end up with TJ. And so throughout the year, we would collect like T-spine rotation numbers, hip numbers, and then pitchers specifically on the recovery days, they would have a full mobility routine to follow. So we did full mobility routine, and then I'm a big fan of like end range isometrics for long duration holds. So we would do a lot of like deep lunge holds for a minute. We would do dead hangs. We do push-up isometrics, things that kind of expose the joint to deep ranges of motion and also help to build stability in those end ranges.
When are you doing those again?
Those would be on like recovery days for our pitchers. And then throughout the week, I'll try to mix them in at least once or twice with our position players, especially the guys who are like a bit stiffer. But a lot of guys too would be on like an individual, like I would write guys individual prep plans. And a lot of those would attack mobility restrictions that they might have. So if a guy has like some hip mobility restrictions, then in his prep routine, he's going to have stuff that's going to address that T-spine, et cetera.
Are you seeing any correlation between T-spine mobility and hip mobility to TJ, Tommy John surgery?
I haven't done a ton of research on it, but my coordinator has expressed that there is a link in his mind and through some research that he's read that, you know, when you have guys who lose, you know, hip internal rotation and hip extension or lose T-spine rotation, then yeah, there's probably going to be a chance that eventually something's going to happen to that arm. And it makes sense. I mean, you think of like dissipate forces throughout the body, like if you don't have the range of motion to get to the positions that maybe you were getting into early in the year, you're looking at trouble.
Speaking of range of motion, I was chatting with the boys in the gym the other day. We were chatting about the good old sleeper stretch.
Oh boy.
And it was interesting, like talking to this baseball player. I was like, hey, like how many players on the team do you see like do the sleeper stretch? He was like, none. I'm like, well, what about when your career started? He's like in his 30s. He's like, oh, yeah, everybody. So I always find that very interesting to see like the shift from an extremely popular exercise, which is like important. Like we want baseball players to have shoulder internal rotation and you know, now nobody's doing it. So yeah. I'm just curious, like, what are you doing to keep, maintain shoulder internal rotation?
Yeah. So a lot of that, in my opinion, was like done by the trainers. So a lot of soft tissue work, a lot of cuff work. The trainers more so worked with like the pitchers on that aspect of things. So they would always have same idea. Like they would have their recovery day would have certain things, their movement day and their compete day would have different rotator cuff exercises. And then, you know, day after a start, they'd be in there getting soft tissue, whether it's on like the pec, posterior shoulder, whatever it may be for that individual. But they would all have like individualized shoulder care programs. But yeah, the sleeper stretch is one that I don't see much anymore for sure. But I think it's like exercises always make their way back. And in my opinion, there's nothing new that anybody's really doing. Like a lot of things, I mean, you start digging in the textbooks of strength and conditioning and you look back at like what the Russians were doing in the 50s, 60s, 70s and all the research they did. And then you look at the programs that people write and it's what they were doing. So you might see a comeback. I hope not, but you might.
Well, you even said it like end range ISOs, like,
yeah,
didn't see that until recently. You know what I mean? Like, and yeah, that was around a long time ago. You know, we used to do towel, you know, ISOs with like partner towel ISOs in football when I was in high school. Like we remember looking at each other like, come on, we can bang around like serious weight here, or we can just hold a towel and do these. That, but like that's something that is making a comeback. So end range ISOs, you wouldn't do that with like pitchers, shoulders, IR, ER type stuff, right? Would you do it? Like, would you incorporate any of that?
I would mix that into their programming, especially on like the position player guys. A lot of them were guys that wouldn't like to go in the training room because in their mind, if they went in the training room, they wouldn't get to play.
That's a different mentality.
Unfortunately, that's like the old school baseball mindset. We tried to nix that, but you know, some guys kind of stuck in their ways. So I would mix in some kind of rotator cuff work in every day of their programming. And that might be basic cable external internal rotation, or it might be end range isometrics in ER and IR.
Are you, go ahead, Rob.
No, yeah, I was going to say, like, I totally agree. I think doing some end range shoulder IR, ER work is important. And especially like in the positions that they're going to be throwing, instead of just like having the arm at the side, is also, I think, a huge, you know, thing you have to get these baseball players in to, you know, prepare them for the positions that they're going to be in on the field. So,
yeah, 100%. I think a lot of guys kind of don't expose themselves to deeper ranges of motion, especially when it comes to the shoulder. And in my opinion, like, you're going to get there one way or another. So I feel a little bit more comfortable knowing that you have some strength in those ranges of motion that you're getting exposed to.
Yeah, when Rob had asked the question, I love soft tissue work. That's what I do. So like I'm down with that. But I'm sure there was some degree of loading that was occurring as well. And that's why, you know, I followed up on that. And that's interesting that like pitchers, you know, we get plenty of pitchers in here and they love the TLC. You know? And then we get, you know, field guys and they're like, no, I'm not hurt. I'm fine.
Yeah.
I can play tomorrow.
Yep.
So I get it. That makes sense. You mentioned VBT earlier. That's one of the questions I had listed down. So we've gone over technology in the weight room and stuff, and even outside the weight room. Is there anything you guys would use technology like during the off season, like to track stuff? Like, because I would assume that a lot of guys are doing their own thing, right? And in the summers, maybe they have a program from you guys are checking in. But I would also imagine that like it would be really cool to have data that you could get while they're away. Is any of that out there?
Some guys do have access to, like, you know, force plates or different metrics that they can kind of follow with like wherever they're at. I know like a couple of our guys train at private facilities that have access to some technology, and so they'll utilize it. But for us, like, we don't have anything that we can like send home to guys or like let guys use. So more so it's just kind of trust,
yeah,
and hoping that you build a good enough relationship that they're going to follow the program and show up to spring training in shape.
I would imagine for you in particular this past year, like single A ball, like I've paid attention more this past year than I have other years. Guys are moving a lot, man. Mm. You got guys moving up, down, you know, injured, whatever. Was that a lot to track? That's a lot on your plate, I would imagine, even compared to like AAA.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Or even higher up. Like, so what were some of those challenges like? Because I'm dying to get into like some private sector versus pro ball or even college, you know, strength conditioning. So this would be an interesting transition to that.
For sure. Yeah. For us, guys moving up and down, it happens a lot. For sure. It probably happens more so in like AAA with guys getting optioned up to the majors or optioned back down to the minors. But for us, we would always send some kind of like a transfer report. So that would include, you know, like their current program that they're on, what they've been working on, their areas of opportunity that they have. If it's a pitcher, what their schedule was and what they had, when they had thrown last. If it's a position player, again, like things that they're working on and the program that they're on. We all have access, or we all had access to that information. All the force plate numbers, all the Nordboard numbers, everybody had access to that so they could see it. So for me, like if I got a new guy who came up from Clearwater, the first thing I would do would jump in and look at their force plate metrics and look at their Nordboard scores and kind of see where they're at, and then look at the program that they're on and start to understand, all right, well, this is where this guy's at, you know, have a conversation with him, see things that he likes, doesn't like, and then work his program basically around that information.
That's great that there's that consistent communication. Obviously each coach is going to have some nuances that you guys do differently or want to focus on differently, but it's great that you guys have that. BFR, you guys, I know that's used a lot in rehab. Are you guys using any of it in the gym?
So in the gym, we didn't really use it much. I would use it with guys who were like rehabbing. So say it was a guy who had like, he couldn't do really any like ground-based conditioning and I wanted to stress his lower body, or he couldn't get in the gym. So we would do some bodyweight BFR, or we'd get on the bike and do some bike conditioning with BFR, which is literal hell.
It's hard. Hey, no thanks.
And then the trainers would use it more so for like rotator cuff work. They would do a ton of stuff for guys with loaded BFR rotator cuff exercises, and the guys at the time hated it, but like when they got done, they were like, oh my god, I feel so much better. And for our position players who actually went in the training room, we would sometimes do like a BFR cycle as like a lower body recovery, and they tended to like that stuff.
It's awesome. That's cool. I mean, we have a lot of some, you know, similar equipment in here, force plates to BFR, VBT, and it's cool to see how Rob and some of the other PTs utilize the technology and that you guys are using it. It's cool. It's kinda, you know, it makes sense. What else you want to add in on this, Rob?
Last like pro ball question, I feel like kind of like two part, like what was your interaction with like the pitching coach, the hitting coach? How did you guys work together to develop players? Cause that's a huge thing in minor league baseball, is like we need to develop players. Talk about some like player development strategies that, you know, what your relationship was and kind of the knowledge you had to have to like have conversations with hitting coaches, have conversations with pitching coaches, and how did you guys work together to develop players?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, that was like probably my favorite part of working for the Phillies. So when I came in, big emphasis was integration and making sure that all the departments are connected with each other. And I think that like as a strength coach, you often get sectored into, well, you're just the weight room guy or you're just the sprint guy, right? And for me, like I took that as a challenge to learn more about the game and understand why certain pitchers throw certain pitches, why certain hitters have certain stances. And we would often go into player deep dives, you know, with certain players, whether it was something that we, you know, the pitching coaches might have seen something in their mechanics or they're introducing a new pitch. And we need to know, you know, if a guy is increasing his slider cutter usage, all right, well, we might need to adjust how much grip work he's doing that day because his forearm's going to get blasted from throwing all those sliders and cutters. For a hitter, maybe he's trying a new stance and we need to make sure that he has the range of motion to get into that position. And I think that stuff was the coolest part of my job, is because we did have a biomechanics lab. And so sometimes we would get information from the biomechs, right? And so you get this information from the biomechanist. We have our, you know, hitting coordinator or pitching coordinator come in, our pitching coaches and hitting coaches sit in, And then we kind of deep dive into these players, you know, oh, these are things that we're starting to see. What can we do in the weight room to address these issues, right? And I think that as a strength coach, like if you want to make money, like that's where you learn to make money.
Hell
like
yeah,
anybody can write a program and get somebody to follow it. But if you can start to understand like human movement and performance on the field and how you can integrate the weight room into that, then that is like, that's it.
I mean, you're the scientist, the mad scientist, right? You're taking all the analytics, mm-hmm. right? You're taking the biomechanics, and that's really putting all the pieces together, especially where you're sitting at a table with those guys. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah, that was cool. We had some pretty awesome discussions, and then, you know, you just start going down rabbit holes.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah,
I'm sure you did. I did have, so I told a patient of mine that, you know, you were coming in. I'm like, all right, do you got a question for him? What do you think? And he said he wants to know why TJ is so much more common now than it was 10, 15 years ago. And obviously we know like velocity, right? That's a huge part of it, direct correlation. Is there anything in the weight room that you guys are doing to try and combat that, whether it's core, you know, lower extremity, more focus, sprints, anything, cuff work? Like, is there anything that you guys are doing, you know, to, I think we kind of talked about it a little bit already, but yeah, dive into that if you don't mind.
Yeah, I mean, those are the two letters that every coach, player, you know, GM hates to see. And I think for us, like when I was in the professional world, like we have so much information. So we understand like, you know, we understand their acute to chronic workload that they're going through. If there's a workload spike, how do we manage that? Do we pull back in the weight room? Do we pull back in the training room when their workload's spiking on the field? I don't know that there's like any one thing you can do to prevent it. I think a big piece of why we're seeing more and more of it is also a byproduct of kids specializing in sports so much younger. Even when I was a kid, like I was telling you earlier, like I played every sport, but these kids, like, they play baseball all year long. So when I worked in the private sector, it made me nauseous how many like 17 and 18 year olds were coming in and having Tommy John. And it blew my mind. But then you look at their game schedule, they play all year long. So in that sense, like, they're missing opportunities in the weight room to develop their body to handle these forces that they're going to be exposed to on the field. And so eventually something in the chain is going to break. And more often than not, it's the elbow, because it can only handle so much force. So I think for any kids, like, play all kinds of sports. And when you have opportunities to get in the weight room and get after it, like, maximize those opportunities. And for like the guys that you see in the big leagues, there's so many factors that go into injury that at the end of the day, sometimes they're just like uncontrollable.
I've seen it in here. I mean, guys have had pain in their elbow and consistently or intermittently for years sometimes. And so, like, at what point did those shearing forces, like, take their final, like, you know, did that ligament kind of give all it had, right? And so it's impossible to say there's one cause and that's the effect. Like, it's impossible. But it is interesting to hear you say that, you know, you kind of pointed to, like, the youth, right? Like,
yeah,
kids need to train more consistently in different sports and not specialize. And TJ is even more common in the South, which is interesting because all year round, it's not, you know, they can play all year round.
Yeah,
that around was, here, you're not seeing baseball outside as much, at least in November, mm-mm. you know, December, but you're seeing it all year round in the South. So yeah, it makes sense that's more prevalent down there.
Yeah, that was my greatest frustration when I worked in Las Vegas was the high school players, they'd be on their high school team, they'd be on two different club teams. You're like, all right, well, when is your opportunity? You're trying to add velocity. Okay, well, you need to put on weight. You're 165 pounds. Yeah. You're going to be a senior. You throw 88. Like, that's not enough. You know, if you really want to go to the big leagues or you want to go to a big D1 school, like, you need to be pumping in the 90s, you know, consistently. And you not training and you playing more baseball is probably not the answer at that time.
Interesting. No, I mean, listen, we see it in here, right? And those are tough conversations to be had with parents and coaches. There's a lot of motivations, as you well,
politics.
As you both well know. Politics, yeah, right. We don't have to dive into all that. But, I mean, your point is well received. What were some of the challenges that you saw outside of the private sector compared to what you saw in the private sector?
I don't know. I think they kind of both have their own separate challenges. You know, in like pro ball, time is the greatest currency, as you go all day long. You know, you're trying to find time to get guys in to do individual work. You're trying to find time to get guys in the lift to go over maybe some nutrition issues that they might have. Be surprised how many guys don't know like basic nutrition information. And then in the private sector, it is getting guys in the door and then keeping guys in the door and being able to show them that if they put in the work, they'll get the reward, especially in like today's society where everything's the like snap the fingers, you get what you want. Strength and conditioning is definitely not that. And so in the private world, you get a high school kid who comes in and he's like, I want to put on, you know, 30 pounds and I want to throw 5 mile an hour harder. It's like, all right, well, how much time do you have? Can you devote your next 4 to 6 months to getting into the gym and getting after it? Or are you going to come in once a week and see how it goes? You know, those are the, I think those were the, probably the biggest challenges of the two different worlds.
Beautifully said, man. Time, right? Because we've talked about that in here before. We had Sam Whitney on, who was at Temple, and now he's more private sector. And he said, like, hours, man, like all day. And now you need time to prep, right? You got to look at the analytics. You got to program, right? I mean, that takes, that's a full schedule right there, like being in lab, right? And then everything you just said in terms of time was conversations, right? Communication with players, coaches. And so that's, I get it, man. Like, there's only so many hours in a day where I can communicate with people. I can do myself in the lab late at night or early in the morning, right? So that's really interesting, but makes sense. In the private sector, how much of it has to do with, like, it's all about value, right? The value you can offer in a professional setting is, you know, during the day or in conversations. The value you offer in a private sector is trying to convince kids or parents or coaches what those kids should be doing. So is there anything that you implemented in the private sector that you felt was, you know, influential in how those kids developed?
Yeah, for sure.
For strength coaches out there that are listening.
Yeah, definitely. I think in the private sector, any time you can create competition within the weight room is the easiest way to get athletes to work harder. And even if you work with general population clients, like, same thing. People love to see their name on the board, whether it's a vertical jump or a deadlift or a squat or whatever it may be. That is the easiest way to build competition. So that was the first thing I did, was put up a huge whiteboard and list, you know, the different age groups and let guys and girls get after it and see who climbed to the top. And a lot of times the people who ended up on the leaderboard would be the same ones who were going to PBR events, like the baseball report, and, you know, setting new 60-yard time dash, like 60-yard PRs, or throwing harder. Then that just kind of becomes its own marketing tool. Yeah. You know, you get testimonials from those athletes. You get testimonials from, you know, whether it's the minor league or professional guys you might work with who stayed healthy all year or had their best year of their career. You're not necessarily the person that help them, that made them get that great year, but you are a small piece in the puzzle that, you know, set them up for success in that coming season.
I love that. Rob, you want to answer that question?
Yeah, I mean, competition's good. Like, I just try to, the training sessions with kids, like, I want that to be the best 1 hour of their day. If I can be that person's best 1 hour, then I think I did a pretty good job. And then just from like a customer service standpoint, like, I think the small things matter. Texting back really quickly, emailing back really quickly, you know, smiling when people come in. All those little things, I think, add up over time to where when they look back and they're, oh, yeah, Rob, yeah, that was great. That was a good time. So I feel like just like those little things add up to provide a good experience, which then in turn like creates a good gym culture. And I think when you have good gym culture, friends tell friends and you get referrals. So, yeah.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, that was worked. So I was like a personal trainer before I started to get my master's and moved on to Las Vegas. And, you know, when you're one-on-one in a session, like, you have 1 hour to make that person feel special. And if you don't, they're probably not going to come back to you time after time. So if you have good retention numbers when you're training one-on-one, like, you start to understand that in a sense, like, you're on performance when you're training that individual. And when I went out to Vegas, that same idea, like, I wanted a culture where people wanted to show up and people wanted to be there because their friends were coming and they were all going to lift and get after and they were going to have a good time. We're going to play loud music. We're going to lift heavy weights and we're going to have some fun doing it. And I think when you have that, like you said, like, they police themselves, they they push each other. There's probably some smack talk going on in the weight room and it's fun. And those are the people that, like, I mean, I still text people that were like my day one clients, like, they came to my wedding, some of them. Like, their friends for life.
Are special.
Yeah. Like, yeah. It's a cool experience.
Yeah. Like, I had two guys in today. Haven't seen them in, I don't know, 7 months, you know, 8 months. We got lunch, hung out, and talked for like an hour and a half.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
Been cool to watch.
Yeah. Like, that, like, really goes a long way, I feel like. And letting your quote unquote clients know that like you're in their corner. Clients know that like they can depend on you. And I think you're doing a pretty good job.
Yeah. I mean, I would say, I think your, I'll say clinic, but gym, whatever you want to call it, needs to be
training facility.
That's it. I like that. It really needs to, it needs to be able to mold, right? It needs to be able to change, right? It needs to be plastic to be a competitive environment, you know, maybe a little cutthroat, maybe a little trash talk, maybe a little aggressive, but also needs to be conforming and empathetic. And, you know, if someone needs a hug, I'll throw them out. Like, let's get a hug on, you know, if you want to compete, like I've played tag with some kids. Yeah. Like I don't usually win. I always win.
Okay.
If I got to cheat, I'll cheat. But
Mark, what was it like going from the private sector dealing with kids, college kids, pro kids, adults, to maybe like professional baseball players that didn't speak English?
Oh yeah, that was a learning experience. My first 4 or 5 months in pro ball was in the FCL, which is the complex league, which is our rookie league. And 75%, I would say, is, you know, non-English speaking players, most of them from the Dominican or Venezuela, Puerto Rico.
75% of the players do not speak English on your team.
Venture that.
Like, I don't think a lot of people 50. Know that. I don't think people know that. And pro ball, that's the numbers you're looking at.
Yeah. And even at high A, like, it's crazy. It was probably 30, 40%. That now, as they get older, they can speak broken English and they can get by. But when I first got there, like, but you're immersed in the culture, right? Like, you're there every single day with these players. And you start to pick up, if you're open to it, at least I'll say, like, you start to pick up how to coach in Spanish, how to conversate in Spanish. And, you know, I had taken Spanish in high school, but it had been 10 years since I had utilized it.
That's a different kind of Spanish than they're speaking.
Oh, big time. Yeah. I mean, when you start talking to some of the Dominican players who speak their own version of Spanish and have Spanish slang, like, sometimes, and if you speak Spanish to them, sometimes they immediately think that, like, you fully speak Spanish. So then they start talking to you and you're like, yeah, you're like, whoa, man, hold on. What did you just say? But I will say, like, it taught me patience. It taught me empathy, because these guys come from nothing. Like, a lot of them come from literal nothing. Like, they're 15. They go to our academy. They are given a chance to play professional baseball to feed their family. And when you start to, like, build relationships with these guys, and they start to trust you, it's pretty special what you can do with them and like what they'll trust you to do. Because a lot of them don't like to lift. Like, they don't want to be sore. A lot of them have low training ages. They're just not exposed to this type of lifting. So you kind of have to ease them in. And then once you start to get them to go and they start to again, like, see results and they start to trust you, then it's pretty cool.
I love it, man. This has been like eye opening for me, and we've had some different coaches in that seat, and this has been really cool, man. All right, private sector, Vegas. What one thing you learned that you're taking with you forever?
That's a good question, man. I think how to build a culture in a facility. It was a big facility. Like, the physical therapy side crushed it. And the sports performance side hadn't been ran in like 3 or 4 years by anybody who like really wanted to make it something.
So you mean it was closed or just not doing well?
Yeah, it was just, wow, not, it was just like, it was just getting by. And they had, you know, a handful of trainers come through, and it was just kind of like, it was random. Like, the pitching coach at the College of Southern Nevada knew somebody who knew somebody, and I somehow got connected with them. And they flew me and my wife out, and they interviewed me, and they were like, is this something you want to do? No, I mean, I walk in and the guy has like Greg Maddux jersey, Frank Thomas, Aaron Rowan, Bryce Harper. Like, this guy had worked with Hall of Famers.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I mean, if these people are coming in, like, I'm down, let's go. And they basically were like, look, nobody's ran it in 3 years the way we wanted to run, so have at it. And they just basically like gave me the keys. So I went in and kind of flipped the model that they were doing. It was a lot of personal training. I didn't want to do personal training anymore. Just flipped it to a semi-private. Everybody was still on individualized programming. You know, we had 6 to 10 people in each session. And within 3 months, they were making a profit. And within 6 months, we were like blowing it out of the water. And it was sick. It was awesome.
Sounds familiar. Yeah, that's pretty cool. No, man, I love that. I love that. Why the semi-private versus the personal training? Just for craps and giggles.
Partially my sanity.
Personal training's tough to bring the juice every day. 8 hours a day.
I worked at
it's very hard.
Philadelphia Sports Club in Lifetime when I first started training. And when I got to my like busiest point, I was doing 10 sessions in a day. And like sometimes they'd be like 10 sessions in a row.
Yeah.
And by your 10th session, like you're trying to give that person the same energy you gave session one of the day, but you are depleted at that point. So for me, it was like, if I can have six people in a room, and I'm kind of ADD, so I'm all over the place, man. Like but it locks me in when I have that going on. And then it's just more exciting. You know, you have a little bit of camaraderie between the people in the sessions. They start to know each other. You have this little community that you're building. And I think you can create something really special when you start to build a community within a facility.
All right. So fast five, you got five quick questions, simple. Don't need long answers, but if you want to, go for it. Here we go.
Try to keep them short.
Yeah, not whatever you want, man. Floor is yours. Should pitchers bench press?
Dumbbells, I don't care. It depends on body type, but yes, I don't mind it.
Back squat versus front squat?
Front squat all day.
What Olympic lifts should baseball players avoid?
Oof. I think you can do variations of each lift, but the actual execution of a full snatch requires an extensive amount of knowledge and mobility. And I avoid that for the most part. Cleans, I had some guys do cleans. They liked it. They had done them before. But the full like clean and jerk and snatch, I've never really been a huge proponent of that with baseball players. Just make too much money with their arms.
Most valuable analytic that you use on the day-to-day last year?
The force plates. I love the force plates. I don't know. I like data.
Who is the best athlete on the field? What position typically is the best athlete on the field?
Center fielder.
Quick answers.
Hand down.
Gold. Great answers. And the snatch answer was like clean. Like that was great. A great answer. I would agree. I think snatch is like the easy take. That's a very technically challenging lift, right? But also for anyone who throws, it's also, you know, a vulnerable position because there may be some hypermobility there. So,
big time.
But no, great. Mark, this has been awesome, man. We got to get him back. I don't know if I said that on the air before, like live. So what's the best way for our listeners to find you, contact you,
reach
you, like email, phone, Instagram, like throw out whatever you can.
TikTok.
Definitely TikTok. Not TikTok. I don't mess with TikTok.
But Rob's a big TikTok guy.
Instagram at Mark Jesse Training. And then my email is just mark@markjessetraining.com.
So, okay.
Yeah. And feel free to reach out.
And what's next for Mark Jesse?
Looking to start my own business. So be on the lookout. Hopefully some big things coming in the new year.
What a teaser. All right. When it's up and running, you know, for the grand opening, we'll maybe do the podcast live at the grand opening.
Let's go.
All right. Done. That's a wrap. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast. If you'd like this episode, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It would mean so much to me if you could leave us a 5-star review so more listeners like you could get this important information. See you next time.